All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969 with the United States Army. Welcome to our program. I'm really excited to have you here today. We're going to be talking about the Holocaust, and we're also going to be talking with a gentleman who was an interrogator for the American Army during World War II. His name is Guy Stern, and Guy was born in Germany. He was sent to America in 1937 when he was 15 years old. He attempted to join the Navy, but they wouldn't let him join the Navy after the beginning of World War II because he was not a native-born speaker of German. He said 6 months later he got drafted by the Army anyway and ended up in intelligence. He went back to Germany as an interrogator for German prisoners of war. The second part of the program, my partner Jim Falsone will be talking with the Holocaust Memorial Center here in Farmington Hills, Michigan, and his guests will include the Director of Education, Ruth Bergman, and Events Director, Sarah Saltzman, from the Holocaust Memorial Center here in, as I mentioned, in Farmington Hills, Michigan. So first, before we get into our program, of course, I want to make sure that we mention our loyal sponsors. We couldn't do our program without them. And that would be Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. Call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org. The Eisenhower Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Jacksonville, Florida. Their After the Impact program goes after awareness campaigns and state-of-the-art imaging to help veterans, first responders, and athletes. Go to eisenhower.com for more information. VetBiz Central, veterans helping veterans, assisting veterans, active duty, guard, and reserve members in the formation and expansion of their businesses. Go to VetBizCentral.com for more. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the Vietnam Veterans of America Post 310, American Legion Post 46, and the VFW Post 423. All these loyal supporters of Veterans Radio. Learn more about these organizations and the services they provide on our website. That's veteransradio.net/our sponsors. Please do go and check those organizations out. They're really helpful to you as a veteran, and they're also helpful to us since they are sponsoring our program, of course. All right, so we're going to get right into our program. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we will have our interview with Guy Stern.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And yep. My guest today is Guy Stern. And let me tell you a little bit about Guy's background. During World War II, the United States formed an elite intelligence unit of mostly German Jewish academics at Camp Ritchie in Maryland. Their job was to devise ways to break the morale of the SS and the German troops that were captured. These men were also often credited with bringing an early end to the war. And one of those heroes is joining us right now, and that is Guy Stern, who is a distinguished professor emeritus of German literature and cultural history at Wayne State University. He is one of these Ritchie boys. And we're very fortunate today to have him back on Veterans Radio. So, Guy, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back once more.
It's nice to have you again. As I mentioned when we were talking earlier, that the Ritchie boys were this group of soldiers and so forth that were almost all of them were from Europe at one point or another. You mentioned earlier that some of them were also Americans that were fluent in German and other languages. How did you get involved with them, and how did you get to America in the first place?
Okay, my parents, seeing the growing restrictions and chicanery against Jews in Germany, knew that we had to get out of there.
When did you arrive in the United States?
I arrived in 1937.
And you were how old at that time?
I was 15 years old.
Okay, so we've got you here now. And you continued living in the States, and you graduated high school in St. Louis, Missouri. Is that correct?
That is correct, and then entered St. Louis University.
Okay, and while you were at St. Louis University, the war broke out, Pearl Harbor, and you decided to go down and enlist. How did that go?
Yes, the first step was I tried to enroll in naval intelligence, which was trying to recruit people proficient in the language of our enemies, and they found me competent, but they also deficient in one quality. I was not a native-born American. My accent betrayed me, so they said, no, we can't take you because we only take American-born soldiers. And then, however, the draft came, and they apparently were less choosy and let me in.
But it wasn't the Navy. It was the Army, wasn't it?
It was the Army.
But when you got drafted into the Army, you went through your basic training, and the next thing you know, you're on your way to some special place. Where was that special place?
Yes, I got my basic training at Camp Barkley, Texas, and then was transferred on orders that I could not open immediately, as the lieutenant told me. But I found out quick enough I was headed for the military intelligence MITC training camp, and that started me on my career as a interrogator and interpreter of German written material or printed material that I was able to get a hold of.
Well, one of the things that I learned about the Ritchie Boys, for our listening audience, there's a great documentary out there called The Ritchie Boys. You can find it on YouTube and other places. And Guy was a participant in that along with a number of his other buddies. It's really a nice, it's a nice way of telling your story. And the training was very intense there at Camp Ritchie, and you were actually, they called it, you guys kind of renamed it to Military Institute of Total Confusion.
That is correct. We had a sense of humor.
That is true. So can you tell me a little bit about what your training involved?
Yes. It was every aspect of intelligence work, ranging from the Morse code to reading aerial maps, drawing maps on very limited, confined to limited territory, and learning some of the methods of interrogating, of methods of looking for hints that appeared, say, by some chance, got through the censor in German newspapers, and to be very watchful for information that would be of strategic or tactical value to our armed forces. I was eventually put in charge of answering all the various inquiries that came from units, from the quartermaster to the medics, to the artillery, who wanted to have certain specified information. And it was our job. I was, in fact, then head of the survey section, and we gathered all the information we could. And as I found out later, from a in a historian of American intelligence that more than 60% of the valuable information needed for our warfare came from the Ritchie Boys. We were decorated as a unit for that, and yes, it was a good fight.
It was a good fight. So after you were at Camp Ritchie and you were deployed, is the term, and ended up landing on French soil at Normandy 3 days post the initial invasion. Is that correct?
That is correct. 3 days after, but of course we hadn't established more than a beachhead at that time.
How would you describe your feelings when you landed on Normandy?
Yes, the feelings as we were going on a PT boat were in our Jeep that we had waterproofed, was as everybody else, whatever unit you belong to, we had fears and anxieties, and so did I. But in my case, two other anxieties came to the fore, and one of them was that as a Jew, if captured, I did not think it would be a rosy future for me in German captivity. And the second private concern I had is that I was squeamish. So if, let's say, my mother cut her hand in when she was preparing a meal, I had to run out of there because the sight of blood really bothered me. And so I thought, that's not a good characteristic coming ashore on the bloody shores of Normandy. But much to my surprise, the moment I set my foot on shore and saw some of the vestiges of soldiers killed in battle, this whole concern went out the window.
And you got to work right away, didn't you? You mentioned that as soon as you hit the beach, somebody needed you to turn to interrogate somebody.
That is correct. As I got ashore, I heard a familiar voice, one of our fellow soldiers who had arrived, an interrogator who had arrived one or two days earlier than me, shouted at me, "Hey, Stern, get the heck over here because we have too many prisoners. I'm swamped." I ran over there. And a few minutes later, I was confronted by a German battle-hardened artillery soldier for my first interrogation.
I can only imagine how that felt. In the military, all your training kicks in, doesn't it?
Yes, all the training fell into place. Camp Ritchie had superbly prepared us for what our assignment continued to be for the rest of the war.
Okay, well, we're talking here with Guy Stern, who was one of the Ritchie Boys, and he was sent back to Europe. He's originally from Germany, and he was sent back during World War II to act as an interrogator for captured German POWs. So my question, I guess, is how long did it take you to get across France back into Germany? This June of 1944, when did you finally get to Germany?
Well, I can't pinpoint that, but any history book can tell us how we advanced through the Battle of Falaise-Argentan in France, how we went on through Belgium, finally got to Germany. And that must have been maybe I can't specify, but it was quickly, it wasn't quickly. It was, and then we ended, were in the setback by the Battle of the Bulge, the German counterattack. We had to retreat after that temporary defeat until our Air Force, prevented before by bad weather, could help us and mash the German advances.
Yeah, and then you ended up back in Germany. There is one story that you are well known for, and that is your pretending to be a Russian commissar. And can you tell me how that came about, and why would the Germans be afraid of you?
Yes, that's exactly was the premise, that we could scare them in interrogation, which otherwise they would see right through that we were trying to get vital information for the Air Force on landmarks, for targets, on the movement of, say, one factory to another place where we needed to locate it, or the Air Force asked, we are not quite sure whether we knocked out this factory completely. Can you get some inside information from a prisoner? So that all fell into place. And I think the only real obstacle we had is when we used our various deceptive devices to get information on ordinary questions that we asked. We could disguise the questions so that the Germans would still would be tricked into giving away valuable information. On the other hand, when we asked about stuff for the Air Force, an assignment that fell to my friend Fred Howard, then the Germans could see through it, because why would you ask for landmarks to an optic factory, or whether a factory had rail connections to the main system of railroads, of tracks? And they knew immediately we asked that for the purpose of bombing them. So they refused answering until we found a method of scaring them into answering. And that was that we had known through the war that the Germans were deathly afraid of being confined in a Russian pre-W camp, because there were memories that they had of having been rather brutal while attacking the Soviet Union. And so we found a way to exploit that fear. After several, we discussed all sorts of possibilities, and then I disguised myself as a Russian commissar. And my tent was identified as that of Commissar Krukov, liaison officer. That sign was in three languages, and inside the tent where Fred brought every reluctant prisoner, there was a picture autographed to Commissar Krukov by Comrade Stalin, and some of them saw that. So they really believed, or many believed, in fact, most, believe that we were able to get a Russian there, and that he would take them and ship them to the salt mines in Russia. And that scared them, or many of them, sufficiently to give us even the information about Air Force targets, about landmarks, and the like.
Well, you had to disguise yourself as this Russian commissar, and the story of how you came up with your accent I found is interesting. How did you do that?
Yes, that was first of all, I exchanged my GI uniform for those purposes by a Russian uniform parts that came up in a phantasmagoric uniform, and we exchanged that with Russian prisoners or liberated prisoners who got in exchange some of our discard clothes. And I put medals around that uniform that we took away from memorabilia that the Germans had hunted down and now had brought as trophies to with them. And so I was a medal-behung soldier for the Russian cause. And then the accent about which you asked, that was a curious coincidence. Every Sunday, my aunt and uncle and I and their son and occasionally daughter listened to a radio program by Eddie Cantor, and he had a minor role for one of his actors who played the mad Russian. And he had found a way of suggesting a Russian accent in his English. I did the same, imitating him, and put it into my German when interrogating the hapless German who came to my attention.
I am sure that you scared them witless. Let's put it that way.
Yes. The moment they came into my tent, I was absolutely charging with anger at the particular prisoner for any reason that I could find, and that scared them even more. And that's way we broke those prisoners frequently as well. Not all of them, but
I wanted to point out to our audience that you mentioned that the Ritchie boys always adhered to the Geneva Convention. You never touched a prisoner, never hit one or anything along those lines.
Yes, we did not touch. That was one of the first items of training at Camp Ritchie. We have a convention, as they said, we have a treaty among nations called the Geneva Convention that you can use pressure, but no ever corporeal touching them or doing physical violence.
Okay, and it's nice to know that at least we adhered to that most of the time. I think that's important. When you were in Germany and the war finally ended, were you able to go back to your hometown?
Yes. I got special permission from my superior officer to go to my hometown in the north of Germany. And the reason he had to get clearance for that, northern Germany or big parts of it were under British occupation, and so he got permission from the commandant in my particular city. And so if a buddy of mine and I, he had also relatives in northern Germany, we could drive to Hildesheim and thereby I could go there and make inquiries about my parents.
Who unfortunately were lost in the Holocaust.
That is correct.
That's correct. And that's kind of the transition I wanted to go to, is that the remainder of our program today is going to be about the Holocaust Memorial here in Michigan. And I know that you were involved in it, and I wanted you to tell our audience a little bit why that particular organization is so important to you.
It is important to me because I admire the people who actually survived the camps, even the designated death camps, and I admired them, and I thought if I did any civic voluntary service, I could help. And the our founding rabbi, Rabbi Rosenzweig, asked me he could use me first as liaison to universities. Coming out of the war, I'd continued my education, and I got into various roles at his early, unfortunately, early death. I was put in as temporary director of the Holocaust Museum. I've served in various capacities. Currently, I have been assigned a very satisfying piece of work, and that is the so-called Institute of the Righteous, which put differently is both the spread of altruism, the service to others, whom was to strangers as an ideal, and implanted in high schools as a worthwhile cause, and secondly, to find out what prompts people to do this heroic and dangerous service, helping the suppressed despite orders from the Nazi powers.
And I know that you're involved with the educational program that you mentioned when we talked before about putting the Holocaust into the curriculum in all of Michigan's public schools.
Yes, I said that not about myself so much, no, not at all at the moment, but rather we were given a very important assignment, we meaning the staff of the Holocaust Museum, because about a year or 9 months ago, the law was passed that Holocaust education became compulsory in Michigan high schools, and so Michigan needed new staff or staff proficient in other disciplines, but had to acquire the additional skill of being proficient in teaching Holocaust history and service. So that keeps me still connected and employed by the Holocaust Museum. It also keeps my wife and me in bagels. So I'm still an employee at a fairly advanced age of a highly respected organization.
Well, you certainly are. And Guy Stern, I want to thank you very much for your patience and for being on Veterans Radio again today. And I want to make sure that you and your wife stay safe and take care of yourselves. I mean, you're only 99 years young. There's plenty more to go, right?
That's highly optimistic. But what I still want to say is that the Holocaust Museum is open again and has shouldered that additional responsibility beyond being showing our exhibits and thereby or as a helpmeet or for informing the public what happened in the Holocaust. We have a website, and anybody who wants to contact us and bring anybody with him or herself, that is important, taking parts in our rounds of leadership by our docents who take the people through the museum, inform them, and we are only too happy to service that purpose. Just call us, and I'll be happy to help anybody who came as a result of your fine program.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Guy, again. And we've been talking with Guy Stern of the Holocaust Museum here in Michigan, and also his history and his story with the Ritchie Boys, German immigrants who ended up going back to Germany during World War II to act as interrogators. Again, I encourage you to go to watch their documentary on the Ritchie Boys. There's also a number of books out there about the Ritchie Boys. I think you'll find them to be great. Great stories about great men and women in the service of their country. So, Guy, thank you very much, and we'll be in touch again, hopefully in the near future.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again. Okay, that was Guy Stern. He's a fascinating man, isn't he? The great story that he has. We're going to be taking a quick break right now, and when we come back, we will be talking with Jim Falsone and Ruth Bergman and Sarah Salzman from the Holocaust Memorial Center here in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Stay tuned for that interview.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
First Lieutenant John Fox called in artillery fire on his own position. Details after this. On Christmas night in 1944, enemy soldiers in civilian clothes gradually infiltrated the town Fox and his men were in, and by early morning, the town was largely in hostile hands. An organized attack by uniformed German units began at 4 a.m. Being greatly outnumbered, most of the American forces were forced to withdraw from the town, but Fox and other members of his observer party voluntarily remained on the second floor of a house to direct defensive artillery fire. Fox reported the Germans were in the streets and attacking in strength. He then called for defensive artillery fire to slow the enemy advance. As the Germans continued to press the attack towards the area that Fox occupied, he adjusted the artillery fire closer to his position. Finally, he was warned that the next adjustment would bring the deadly artillery right on top of his position. After acknowledging the danger, Lieutenant Fox insisted that the last adjustment be fired, as this was the only way to defeat the attacking soldiers. Later, when a counterattack retook the position from the Germans, Lieutenant Fox's body was found with the bodies of approximately 100 German soldiers.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org. Or call 810-767-VETS.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and we're going to go right to the interview with my partner, Jim Falsone, who's going to be talking with the Director of Education and the Events Directors at the Holocaust Memorial Center here in Farmington Hills, Michigan.
As you know, Veterans Radio America has a partnership with the Association of Michigan and Military Organizations to bring you a quick look at an AMMO member that supports the history of military service here in the state of Michigan. And we encourage you to visit AMMO on Facebook. And this particular organization who we're talking to. So we want to welcome to Veterans Radio a couple of representatives of the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Ruth Berkman, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Sarah Saltzman, also welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start with you, Ruth. Why don't you tell our Veteran Radio audience about the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan, its mission, its purpose, you know, how long you've been around, and what, all the good work you're doing.
Sure, thank you. So our mission is to engage, educate, and empower our visitors by remembering the Holocaust. And we want our visitors and our audience to apply the lessons that they've learned through the Holocaust to the world today. We have a museum with artifacts such as an authentic World War II era boxcar. We have text panels, photos, video testimony, an artwork, and a sapling from the tree that was outside of Anne Frank's hiding place, all ways to engage in the story of the Holocaust, the lives that were lost, the examples of people who risked their lives to save others, including, of course, our amazing, American military. And we ask our guests to react to contemporary challenges such as racism and prejudice based on what they learn at the museum.
Well, this is a tremendous facility, really, to teach that history from 1933 to 1945 and in Nazi Germany that people forget about. And when we talk to these big national important museums and centers, part of it is you're teaching a bit of history that just doesn't get enough time in a high school or grade school anymore. Isn't that kind of the problem?
Well, yes, there's always a lot of pressure to teach so much. And one of our goals is to help teachers find ways to teach the Holocaust impactfully, accurately, and with these lessons in mind. We have workshops for our teachers throughout the state of Michigan where we teach them pedagogic principles, how to teach the Holocaust. We give them reliable resources to use and to teach the lessons of the Holocaust so that it's not just a history lesson. You know, we all make choices in our lives. We all have responsibility to stand up to injustice and to take action. And you know, Jim, that as our veterans know and our listeners know, we in America have important choices that we make to stand up for the things that we believe in. And that's really what we want our visitors to come away with from our museum.
And we're talking to Ruth Berkman, who is the Director of Education at the Holocaust Memorial Center, as we put a spotlight on an AMMO member. And Ruth, it's not just the purging of 6 million Jews, but it was really about a much broader racial, ethnic, social attempt to eradicate people. And I suspect that your center not only focuses on the Jewish population, but others who were also similarly persecuted.
Yes. So the Holocaust is the state-sponsored systematic persecution of European Jewry by Nazi Germany and, of course, their collaborators. But it is absolutely true that there were other people who were targeted by the Nazis for a variety of reasons, and we definitely tell their story as well. We have information about the Roma Sinti, otherwise known as gypsies, and the other peoples, Polish intellectuals and others who were also persecuted by the Nazis. And that's what our new exhibit is about as well.
I think it's sometimes, sometimes easy to pigeonhole what went on and just say, well, it was just about the Jews, but it was also about the Poles and gay men and Jehovah Witnesses and political dissidents and anybody who opposed the party, if you will. So all of those lessons are things that we can apply today, I suspect, is part of what you're trying to communicate at the Holocaust Memorial Center.
Yes, and we really try to teach the lesson that ultimately the Holocaust happened like every event in history happens. You know, it doesn't just happen. People make choices, and people made choices to participate in all of the actions that led up to the genocide and led up to the terrible destruction that occurred during the Holocaust and World War II. And we want people to consider the consequences of hate. And that hate can ultimately go from thoughts in people's heads to terrible, terrible actions.
Well,
and that's a lesson that we can certainly apply today.
Yeah, the consequences of hate is a phrase I just had to write down because I think it's so powerful. And Ruth, you recently wrote an article that showed up in the Times of Israel called "The Lessons of the Holocaust Now More Than Ever." Why is it important to look back and reflect on the Holocaust and learn its lessons today? Why is it more important now than ever?
Well, I think, you know, we don't want to take our democracy for granted, and we have to make choices all the time to make sure that we respond to hate, that we say that it's not tolerated, and teach people how to stand up and fight for the things that they believe in. That's a lesson that never goes away. And I think that in our world today, there's been such a rise in anti-Semitism and in all sorts of prejudices that we need to be reminded that the Holocaust isn't just about what happened in the past and a history lesson, but that we take those lessons and we bring them forward into our lives today and use that as the impetus for being active participants in our democracy.
Tell us a little bit about who comes to visit. And we're coming out of a very strange year where almost, you know, nobody could go visit. But who are the folks who come and the groups that come to the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan?
So the first thing I'd like to tell you is that we are open, and we have an amazing core exhibit, and we invite your listeners to come to us. We are open Sunday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and on Fridays until 2:30 p.m. And we get a variety of visitors. We have general, you know, families and adults who come. We have, in non-COVID times, we have about 35,000 students who come with their schools to visit us. So we have a great variety of people who come. Some are very familiar with the story of the Holocaust and World War II, and some who are really just learning about it for the first time.
Well, and we're within the shadow of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is January 27th internationally. So it's a great time to think about visiting the center or visiting it virtually online. Can you tell our listeners what your website is and how they can learn more about the center?
Sure. So our website is www.holocaustcenter.org. They can also call at 248-553-2400. We do require face masks. We are wheelchair accessible. We have free parking. We follow all the state guidelines in terms of, you know, COVID safety and preparedness. And we invite our audience to come and to explore and see what we have to offer and teach.
Well, I want to turn now to to bring Sarah Saltzman, who's the events director at the center, into the conversation. And Sarah, as we've talked in the past a little bit, online and education, those are two different things, but combined nowadays, is so important. And upcoming events for the center are so important. Can you tell us kind of what's going on and what's coming up?
Sure. Actually, our next event is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and that is on Wednesday, January 27th at 7 p.m. And we're honored to have Patricia Heberer Rice, who is the director of the Division of Senior Historian from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, coming. And she's going to discuss the complicity of physicians during the Holocaust. So her talk is really on how healers became killers. So we will get into Nazi medical professionals and what their role was in really the planning and implementation of Nazi racial policy. We'll talk about euthanasia and sterilization within Nazi Germany.
And is this a live presentation, a video presentation, or both?
It's a virtual. So anyone who would like to come, all they have to do is go to our website, holocaustcenter.org, and they will see an invitation to register on our homepage. It's holocaustcenter.org/January. For those who don't want to make two stops, they can go directly to the registration form, and it will be on Zoom. So we invite everyone to come to that virtual program again on January 27th at 7 p.m. And for those who don't know, International Holocaust Remembrance Day was designated by the United Nations General Assembly as a date to officially commemorate the victims of the Nazi regime and to promote Holocaust education throughout the world. So it's a very important program. And then after that, on January 27th, I do want to mention we also are going to examine a current genocide today, which is the Uyghurs in China. That's also a virtual program, which will be on Thursday, February 11th. And so I invite all of your listeners to always go to our homepage. We always talk about upcoming events. The most recent event coming up will be right there front and center, but there's a tab that says events, and your listeners can just look at that and see what we have coming up for January and February.
And honestly, this is sort of the great work that centers, museums, memorials do all across the country, is this sort of education that is available to people that maybe they don't know about, and that's why we're talking to you. Because you do programs all through the year. There'll be something, I don't know how far out your scheduling goes, but there'll be there'll be something every all year long here in 2021, won't there?
So, yes, there will, Jim, and we are very proud of the fact we have at least two programs a month, and right now they're all online, but we have some really great things coming up. February is, of course, Black History Month, so after we discuss what's happening to the Uyghurs in China, we're going to talk about learning from the Germans, how the country of Germany learned to deal with the memory of evil and how it applies to the United States and our concept of what happened during the Civil War. In March, we're looking at Women's History Month, and we will have a special preview of a movie called A Call to Spy, which is about women spies during World War II, and we'll have a talk back with some of the people in the film, and that actually features, it's about Virginia Hall, who was one of the most famous spies in World War II, and she became a member of the CIA. So we actually schedule all year. We have very interesting things, I think, that your audience will find very informative.
And let me bounce back to you, Ruth, as the Director of Education. As the last year has pushed us all into this virtual world, it's kind of created new educational opportunities to get the message and the mission out, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And we're actually very excited about the different opportunities that we have. So, for example, we have self-guided tours that our visitors can use because we're not able to offer guided tours, as we usually do. So our docents develop these tours, and they can enhance a visitor's exploration of our permanent exhibit. It provides information about artifacts and installations. It's got some questions to spark curiosity. You can get a QR code and follow on your phone as you go through the museum, but it's also on our website. So people can look at the guide before they visit if they want and kind of prepare. And if people feel that they don't really know very much about the Holocaust, this guide will really help them get through our museum. We also are putting our artifacts online and featuring artifacts, and we do that through social media and on our website. And we are creating online opportunities for schools. If they can't come to visit us in the museum, we are preparing lessons that we can zoom into the classrooms and give the students the experience that they would have had here through discussing artifacts and stories of survivors, and really get the fullness that they would have had had they been able to come for a school tour.
And people do learn by hearing the stories. You know, I'm going to have you describe what artifacts are, but I also want you to talk a little bit about the power and the importance of the stories that you have at the center.
Absolutely. So I'm going to start with that, actually, about the power of stories. One thing that we absolutely emphasize here is that it's a human story. It's about people making choices, but also we don't focus so much on the fact that, you know, 6 million Jews were murdered, that X number of, Poles or Roma Sinti were murdered, but that they were individuals, that they were people with families and friends and lives, and to really see them as individuals. And people can make a connection to another person. And storytelling is a great way of doing that. We're very honored to have our local survivors who have been able to speak to our visitors, and their stories are also available online through our website. And that's how you make a connection, you know, that it's not just a story that took place long ago, far away in a place with a language I don't speak, but that's a person. That could be my grandmother. That could have been, you know, me. And you hear those stories, and it creates a connection that is stronger than anything, you can read about in a textbook. So that's a very personal stories are a very important part of the Holocaust story. And artifacts are items that are used, you know, from the era of the Holocaust that tell stories. It could be a shoe that somebody wore. It could be a uniform, a piece of art that a survivor made as a way to express and tell the story in an artistic fashion. We have all kinds of artifacts in our museum. We have some artifacts that are from, you know, propaganda that the Nazis were using, like a children's book that taught children to hate, which, you know, just gives me chills every time I think about it, to all kinds of artifacts that our survivors and veterans have given us from their World War II and Holocaust experiences. And we use those artifacts to help tell the story, because it's not about the item. It's about the story that goes behind it. And probably our most striking artifact is right when you walk in our front door, we have a boxcar. It's a genuine boxcar that was used to transport German army personnel and equipment, and it was also used to transport Jews and other prisoners to ghettos and camps. And, you know, you look at that and you really, you know, start to think about the idea that people were put into these trains and taken to they didn't know where, and ultimately to their deaths. It's very powerful to be able to see that boxcar and look inside it and touch it. And it gives us a greater understanding of the experience that the victims of the Holocaust had.
Well, I hope that this discussion leads our veteran radio listeners to not only go online to find out more, but to arrange a visit for themselves, maybe their family members, maybe their schools or clubs or church groups, to the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan. I just appreciate, Ruth Bergman, the time that you and Sarah Saltzman have provided us. And Sarah, why don't you give us the website one more time?
So our website again is www.holocaustcenter.org. And can I do a shout out, Jim?
Please do.
Okay. Before we leave, we have to shout out our favorite veteran, our colleague, Dr. Guy Stern, who is a World War II veteran, just turned 99. So we just want to tell him how much we appreciate him. And I know he listens to Veterans Radio.
Well, we're glad to have that listener, and we're glad for his service. We're thankful for his service, and I think sometimes it's easy to forget what these men and women saw and had to experience and go through in liberating these camps or on the way up to liberating these camps. So these are all good lessons to pass on to our kids and grandkids. So I'm glad you guys are out there doing that and participating with the Association of Michigan and Military Organizations. Ruth and Sarah, thanks for your time here on Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.
I want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. We hope you enjoyed our program. If you have any comments or stories or suggestions for our program, please contact us at veteransradio.net. Until next week, this is Dale Thronberry for Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.